Hello, this is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and welcome to this edition of Rolling Stone. We wrapped up the November 2025 edition of Rolling Stone magazine last week. This week, we're going to take a deep dive into the career of the Rolling Stones, many who say is the greatest rock band of all time. In the Rolling Stone magazine's special edition entitled Mick and Keith and 60 Years of the Rolling Stones. From suburban garages to sold-out arenas, the history of rock has been written by more bands than can be counted. Almost every group starts out like a chameleon, changing colors as a mechanism of survival. And like some chameleons, the average lifespan of a rock band can be measured not in years, but months. Which is why the Rolling Stones, officially now a trio consisting of Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, and Ronnie Wood, three men all pushing age 80, are not only the world's greatest rock band, just like they always claimed, but also the last group of their kind that we may ever see again. Entering their 60th year in existence, the Stones continue to roll. On March 14, 2022, the band announced a European tour to celebrate their diamond anniversary. The plan included shows in 10 countries, including the band's first performances in the UK since the death of drummer Charlie Watts in August 2021. So what if Mick Jagger underwent heart valve replacement surgery in 2019? And what about Keith Richards, the rocker once named most likely to die within the year, way back in 1973. Richards raring to go and has found his second or third or fourth wind after finally kicking smoking. After six decades, the Stones still aren't satisfied. Considering that their last tour, which ran from 2017 to 2021, with a global pandemic sandwiched in between, grossed over $500 million, there seems little doubt that fans will turn out. The world still loves the Rolling Stones, not only for their library of undeniably great music, but also for the image they uphold. The Stones' edge remains sharp, but the danger is gone, replaced by an admirable fortitude to survive. When the band was starting out, the media asked, "Would you let your daughter marry a Rolling Stone?" The question today is more like, "Would you go with your granddaughter to a Rolling Stone concert?" The answer for most of us would be a resounding yes. Much of the credit should go to Jagger and Richards, perhaps the most underrated creative duo in rock history. McCartney and Lennon were always held in higher regard and always will be, but few songwriting teams have ever been on par with the self-proclaimed Glimmer Twins. And yes, that name was always intended as a joke. To appreciate the brilliance, all you need to do is listen. Tumbling Dice still sounds fresh and funky 50 years after its release because it's built on good bones, gospel, blues, boogie-woogie, and is rendered with both craft and feeling. The Stones have always reveled in appealing to the lewd and lowbrow impulses of their fans, but their dirtiest secret may be that when it comes to rock music, they have perfectly refined taste. The biggest and undoubtedly best birthday parties will be staged by the Stones themselves. But all rock fans should take a moment to appreciate the achievements and history-making memories that Mick Jagger and Keith Richards continue to deliver without an end in sight. You can't always get what you want, but we still have the Rolling Stones. What more would you possibly need? The Beatles weren't the only band whose greatest triumphs and most difficult challenges tracked with the ups and downs of a complicated friendship. Two friends. Mick Jagger and Keith Richards did not arrive at the Dartford train station on the morning of October 17, 1961, expecting to begin a lifelong journey together. They were, in fact, going to very different places. Richards, who was 17, was on platform number 2 to take the train to Sidcup Art College, where he was a rather uninterested student, concentrated less on graphic design than on playing his guitar in the school cloakroom. Mick Jagger, older by only 5 months, was on his way to the London School of Economics, where he was in his first year of studying finance and accounting. The two had actually known each other for many years. Their mothers were friendly, and the boys had been classmates at Dartford's Wentworth Primary School from ages 7 to 11. Back then, the Richards family lived on Chastelion Road in an apartment over a little row of shops. The Jaggers were one street over on Denver Road. "We've grown up with each other," Richards told 60 Minutes back in 1994. "I met him in a sandpit at 4 years old. I can't remember when I didn't know him," Jagger told Rolling Stone 1 year later. "We used to play together, and we weren't the closest friends, but we were friends." They had not stayed in touch after leaving Wentworth, going to different secondary schools and leading disparate lives. Jagger, whose father was a physical education teacher, was a middle-class kid, a good student who lived in a detached house. Richards, the son of a factory worker, was decidedly blue-collar, residing in a council flat. His attendance at Side Cup was a last stop for him, an attempt to finish some sort of education after he had been expelled from secondary school 2 years earlier for cutting classes. The one thing the two shared was a love of American rhythm and blues and rock and roll, and when they bumped into each other on the train, Jagger had Chuck Berry's Rockin' at the Hops and the Best of Muddy Waters under his arm. Such records were impossible to come by in their London suburb, and Richards remembered asking, "Where the hell did you get this?" Jagger explained to Richards that he had bought the albums through the mail, riding away to Chess Records in Chicago. Richards had no idea such a thing was even possible. By the time he got off the train at Sidcup, he had not only copied down the matrix numbers of both discs, valuable information for collectors looking for specific editions, but he also had an informal agreement to come rehearse with a band that Jagger was singing for, called Little Boy Blue and the Blue Boys. From that moment on, Jagger and Richards were inseparable. They went to each other's houses to listen to records, with Richards working his way through the guitar moves on each one. They collected albums and went to shows, Jagger once driving them up to Manchester in his parents' Triumph Herald, for a bill that included John Lee Hooker and Muddy Waters himself. Within a few months, they met London guitarist Brian Jones, who had formed an R&B group that included himself, the two boys from Dartford, Dick Taylor, a mutual friend they both knew from Sidcup on bass, Ian Stewart on piano, and Tony Chapman on drums. On July 12th, less than 9 months after Jagger and Richards had bumped into each other on a train platform, the Rolling Stones played their first gig at the London's Marquee Club. "I hope," said Jagger at the time, "they don't think we're a rock and roll outfit." Soon, everyone thought of the Stones as a rock and roll outfit, and many still consider them the greatest one ever to exist. When a band has been around for as long as the Stones, it's hard to think of them as ever having been anything but an established fact. They have graced the grandest of stages for so many years. This is their 60th as a going concern, and their music is so instantly familiar, broadly influential, and undeniably great that the notion that there was ever a world without them seems inconceivable. And everything from their humble beginnings in Dartford to the sold-out stadium shows that have defined them since the early 1990s, has always centered on the relationship between two childhood friends, Mick and Keith. Through all the fights, arrests, addictions, deaths, lineup changes, solo careers, autobiographies, and one-night stands, the band has continued because Jagger and Richards have kept it going, and they seem determined to see things through to the end. "I can't divorce him," Richard said of Jagger nearly 30 years ago, "and he can't divorce me." The Stones ended their first decade with a flurry of brilliance, a four-album run of masterpieces that began in 1968 with Beggar's Banquet and ended with release of Exile on Main Street in 1972. Those records have come to define the essence of the Rolling Stones and are cited by fans and historians as the core of the band's musical legacy. Jack Hamilton, author of Just Around Midnight, Rock and Roll and the Racial Imagination, called this period one of the greatest sustained creative peaks in all of popular music. The incredible songs that came from those albums, Sympathy for the Devil on Beggar's Banquet, Gimme Shelter, and You Can't Always Get What You Want on Let It Bleed, Wild Horses on Sticky Fingers, and Exiles Tumbling Dice, among many others, would remain the basis for the set lists of their epic shows 50 years later. And now, so many decades after the Stones first burst onto the scene, it's hard to tell which is the band's greater legacy, the music or the longevity. Their artistic endeavors give them a starring role on the soundtrack to the 20th century, but their endurance has kept them relevant into the 21st. The band's worldwide tour in support of its 2005 album, A Bigger Bang, grossed a record $558 million. Richard's 2010 autobiography, Life, was a number one bestseller and a Norman Mailer Prize winner for Distinguished Biography in 2011. Of course, we're doing it for the money as well, Jagger acknowledged in 1989. When asked why exactly the band insisted on making albums and going on tour, we've always done it for the money. People get highly paid in rock and roll. That's why it's so attractive. It's like boxing. People don't do boxing for nothing. They start off doing it because they hope to get to the top, because when they get to the top, they'll make lots of money. I mean, that's America. It's certainly a far cry from Dartford, though maybe not necessarily too far from the London School of Economics. There's a certain amount of calculation needed to stick around so long, and it's fitting that after the death of drummer Charlie Watts in 2021, Jones and Richards are the only original Rolling Stones to still be playing in the band. Their friendship has famously ebbed and flowed over the years. Don't get Richard started on what he thinks of Jagger's solo efforts. But their dedication to their partnership remains. And outside of John Lennon and Paul McCartney's songwriting partnership in the Beatles, it is the most significant and certainly the most lucrative in the history of rock and roll. The Rolling Stones skyrocketed to stardom in their early years, but by the end of their first decade together, the band and the members started to unravel. The Rolling Stones began their first decade as a ragamuffin outfit of green teenagers and hardened club musicians, and they ended it as nothing less than the biggest rock and roll band in the world. It was a meteoric rise, and it was not without casualties. There were lineup changes, internal strife, arrests and deaths, as well as a boxed set's worth of incandescent generation-defining music. The Stones lived the rock and roll dream as well as the nightmare and then kept going. For all the import attached to the chance meeting of Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, the driving forces behind the rise and continued success of the Rolling Stones, the band was actually started by Brian Jones and Ian Stewart. Brian Jones, a slight blonde guitarist obsessed with rhythm and blues, was the one who placed the ad in Jazz News in the spring of 1962, recruiting musicians interested in playing rhythm and blues and who were keen to rehearse, to meet him at London's Bricklayer's Arms pub in Soho. Stewart, a beefy boogie-woogie piano player from Scotland, had been the first to respond. He then oversaw the addition of Jagger and Richards. "To me, the Rolling Stones is his band," Richards says of Stewart in his autobiography, Life. "I'm still working for him." Stewart was the sixth member of the Stones, staying on with the group after the addition of drummer Charlie Watts and bassist Bill Wyman in the winter of 1962-63. But after Andrew Loog Oldman, a young publicist for the Beatles until he was fired by the band's manager, Brian Epstein, became the Stones' manager in 1963, Stewart's days were numbered. Oldham felt that six Stones were too many and that the Scotsman's bulky frame did not look right standing next to the waifish Jagger. But Oldham also realized what Stewart meant to the band. Oldham told him that he was off, not out. He could continue playing with the band on records, but only in the shadows on stage, and he would no longer be one of the faces of the group. Stewart assented, and then stayed on with the band for the next two decades until his death from a heart attack in 1985. His arrangements and his driving piano on such hits as Honky Tonk Woman and Brown Sugar were vital to the Stones' distinctive sound. And that loose guitar-heavy sound, coupled with the savvy promotional efforts of Oldham, propelled the Stones to the top in a very short time. In early 1963, they began an eight-month run as the house band at London's Crawdaddy Club and started to attract notice from fans. By the end of the year, they had already scored a modest hit in the UK with their own version of I Want to Be Your Man, a song written by the Beatles, Lennon, and McCartney. The Stones also gained a notorious reputation as a raunchier and more belligerent version of the pop band from Liverpool. The first Stone album in the UK featured five cheerless faces on the cover, and Oldham famously asked one journalist, "Would you let your daughter go with a Rolling Stone?" By the time their cover of It's All Over Now, originally sung by the Womack Brothers, an American R&B group, gave them their first UK number one hit in the summer of 1964, Stones Mania was real. All that was left for Jagger and Richards to click as a songwriting tandem, something Oldham insisted on and which after a rough start happened rather quickly. The duo's riffy bluesy single, The Last Time, topped the UK charts in early 1965, heralding a string of hits over the next 3 years, including I Can't Get No Satisfaction, their first international number one hit, Get Off of My Cloud, Paint It Black, and Jumping Jack Flash. The Stones then began to release a run of classic albums, including the 1966 Aftermath, their first LP comprised exclusively of Jagger Richards compositions. Save for a brief foray into the psychedelia with their Satanic Majesty's Request in 1967, which split critical opinion and was widely seen as an attempt to match the Beatles' success with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, it was as if the Stones could do no wrong. Between 1968 and 1972, they cemented their legacy by putting out four bona fide classic albums, Beggar's Banquet, Let It Bleed, Sticky Fingers, and Exile on Main Street. They could have never recorded another song after that, and their place in the rock canon would have been secure. But the decade began an unraveling, if not of the band itself, then of the individuals within it. Besides the always buttoned-down Charlie Watts, the rest of the Stones lived up to their malignant reputation, including indulging in booze and drugs and women to excess and beyond. There were multiple busts of Jones, Jagger, and Richards for drug possession in 1967 and 68, and heroin had begun to take its hold on Keith Richards. The mercurial Jones, especially, seemed to be on a downward spiral. A brilliant musician, his slide guitar on I Want to Be Your Man, his recorder on Ruby Tuesday, and his sitar on Painted Black are all indelible contributions to the sound of the Stones. He was no songwriter, and he chafed at the rise of Jagger and Richards in the band that he had founded. As Jones descended into substance and alcohol addiction, he became increasingly erratic. His physical abuse of girlfriend Anita Pallenberg drove her into the arms of Keith Richards, with whom she eventually had three children. As a feud between the two men simmered, Jones' contribution to the Stones' music became almost non-existent. His last appearance on an album consisted of minor contributions to two tracks on Let It Bleed. On June 8, 1969, his bandmates fired him. Less than a month later, he was found motionless at the bottom of his swimming pool. Coroner ruled that he had drowned and characterized the incident as death by misadventure, a polite nod to the role that drugs played in his decision-making and lifestyle. Just 2 days after Brian Jones' death, the Stones performed at a free concert at London's Hyde Park, where they paid tribute to Jones and introduced his replacement, guitarist Mick Taylor. But there were still more darker times ahead. On December 6, 1969, a free concert at California's Altamont Speedway erupted in ugly violence when a member of the Hells Angels, who had been hired to assist with crowd control, knifed a man brandishing a gun just feet from the stage. The Peace and Love 60s ended in bloody death. Still, the band played on after the tragic event, churning out hit after hit. The Stones released 60 Fingers in 1971, and then Exile on Main Street a year later. The albums were classics, but there was no recapturing the youthful magic of just a few years before. And by the time the sessions for Exile concluded, Jagger and Richards would face another crisis that almost brought the Rolling Stones to an end. The 10 top songs of the Stones' first decade, as chosen by this rock site Diffuser, included number 1, Gimme Shelter. Number 2, Sympathy for the Devil. Number 3, Dead Flowers. Number 4, I Can't Get No Satisfaction. Number 5, Wild Horses. Number 6, Get Off of My Cloud. Number 7, Jumping Jack Flash. Number 8, 19th Nervous Breakdown. Number 9, Rocks Off. And number 10, Salt of the Earth. By the late 1960s, Keith Richards was self-destructing, and his growing addiction to heroin was further complicating matters with the band. The sessions for Exile on Main Street coincided with the first real test of the partnership between Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. Conducted with mobile equipment in the basement of Richards' massive rented villa in the south of France, while the Stones were tax exiles from Great Britain, primary recording stretched on for nearly a year, with most of it done late at night and attended by a seemingly endless roster of recording technicians, session musicians, girlfriends, wives, and hangers-on. Complicating matters was Richard's growing addiction to heroin, which made an already disorganized recording schedule positively chaotic. That the album was ever finished at all seems, in retrospect, something of a miracle. "Not everyone turned up every night," said bassist Bill Wyman. "This was, for me, one of the major frustrations of this whole period. For our two previous albums, we had worked well and listened to producer Jimmy Miller. At the Villa, things were different, and it took me a while to understand why," said Wyman. Keith Richards spent most of his time upstairs with his girlfriend, Anita Pallenberg, who, like Richards, was also in the throes of heroin addiction. Richard slept from 10 in the morning until about 4 in the afternoon. Richard called this Keith time, but wouldn't descend to the basement until sometime late in the evening, where he would jam with whoever was on hand, which often meant one or more of the other Stones was gone. Mixing and final touches to the album were done in Los Angeles, with Jagger taking over and being unsatisfied with the final result. "When I listen to Exile, it has some of the worst mixes I've ever heard," Jagger said 4 years later during an interview on the 40 Licks tour. "I'd love to remix the record, not just because of the vocals, but because generally I think it sounds lousy. At the time, Jimmy Miller was not functioning properly. I had to finish the whole record myself because otherwise there were just these drunks and junkies," Jagger said. One casualty was the madness of Mick Taylor, the newest member of the Stones, who actually never had to go into exile in the first place for the simple reason that he hadn't earned as much money as his new bandmates. He nevertheless followed into France, where he slowly came to realize that he had made a mistake in the summer of 1969. Living in a strange country and trapped in a muggy basement for marathon recording sessions, the quiet Mick Taylor, who was 5 years younger than Jagger and Richards, grew frustrated. It didn't help that he felt he wasn't getting proper credit for the songs he was helping to compose, or that his relationship with Richards was tense. Taylor stayed on with the Rolling Stones for 2 more albums, but then he abruptly quit in December 1974. To replace him, the group chose Ronnie Wood, who was a guitarist in the English band Faces, as well as good friends with Richards. Wood played on one Definitive Stones album, the 1978 Body Funky Some Girls, but it was clear that he had joined a group in decline. The band's releases regularly shot to number one, but the number of indelible songs they yield had begun to shrink dramatically. Richards, meanwhile, seemed bent on self-destruction, and only the threat of real consequences seemed to sober him up. In 1977, he and Anita Pallenberg were arrested in Toronto for heroin possession for the purpose of trafficking, a charge that could have meant a jail sentence of up to 7 years to life. Richard says his lawyers told him that he was facing a probable sentence of 2 years. Some, including Mick Jagger, expressed concern about the future of the band. But Richards pled guilty in 1978 to simple possession and was given a suspended sentence and a year of probation, crisis averted. But as the guitarist began to get sober and began to reinsert himself as a leader of the Stones, Mick Jagger became frustrated. "In that period, I had nothing to do with the running of the Stones," Richards says. Jagger had assumed control. He assumed that he was the leader. So when I stopped doing dope and I said, "Hey, Mick, thanks for holding the fort. Give me the load. I'll carry my load now," it surprised me that instead of a sigh of relief, Jagger didn't want to relinquish control. Since 1974, Richards and Jagger have been co-producing the Stones records as the Glimmer Twins. The nickname was a running inside joke between the two dating back to the late 1960s. But in reality, one of the twins had been mostly unavailable. It was Jagger who had kept the band together and productive while Richards was dealing with his demons. "When Keith was taking heroin, it was very difficult to work," Jagger told Rolling Stone magazine in 1995. "He still was creative, but it took a long time." It was under those circumstances that the Stones released Tattoo You in 1981, widely regarded as the band's last great record. It was actually a collection of unreleased songs from earlier albums. Start Me Up, a classic example of a Richards riff using the open five-string tuning technique he had been perfecting since the late 1960s, was an outtake from the Some Girls sessions. Waiting on a Friend was from 1973's Goat's Head Soup. Some of the songs actually feature the playing of Mick Taylor. "It's all a lot of old tracks that I dug out," said Jagger later in 1995. The rest of the band were hardly involved, and then I took it to producer Bob Clearmountain, who did this great job of mixing so that it doesn't sound like it's from different periods. The album Tattoo You was the last Stones album to reach number one, where it stayed for 9 weeks. The band spent the better part of the next year on the road, touring in support of the record. When they returned to the studio in Paris in late 1982, they assumed they were going to work on songs for the next album. Instead, they started to come undone. "It was the beginning of the 1980s, wrote Richards in his autobiography Life, when Mick started to become unbearable. The top songs released by the Stones from 1972 to 1979, as chosen by the site You Discover Music, included number one, Shine a Light. Number two, Beast of Burden. Number three, It's Only Rock and Roll, But I Like It. Number four, Miss You. Number five, Do 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 Do. Number six, Before They Make Me Run. Number seven, Torn and Frayed. Number eight, Angie. Number nine, Dancing with Mr. D. And number 10, Fingerprint File. The 1980s brought more lineup changes to the band. Some members explored solo work, and the decade further marked the dissolution of Mick and Keith's friendship. By 1982, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards were completely different people from the scrawny, self-doubting teenagers who auditioned for Ian Stewart at the Bricklayer's Arms pub 20 years before. They had been living rock and roll lives for so long, full of music and tours and drugs and women, that they had been transformed. One of the casualties of that change was their friendship. Jagger and Richards had grown apart, and neither one was crazy about who the other had become. Richards was sober for the first time in a long while and getting ready to settle down somewhat, with plans to marry American model Patty Hansen, whom he had met at Studio 54 back in 1979. The iconic twist was that the jet-setting Mick Jagger, the man of wealth and taste, was the one who was actually a regular at the New York disco. As his influence over the Stones had grown during Richards' drug-addled neglect of the band, they would have fallen apart without Jagger. So had his ego, at least in the eyes of Richards. The immediate problem was that Mick Jagger had developed an overriding desire to control everything, Richards wrote in his 2010 autobiography, Life. As far as he was concerned, it was Mick Jagger and them. The studio album Undercover, which came out in late 1983, reflected the growing rift between the two men. Musically, this meant that the sound was all over the place, from reggae to new wave to soul to hard rock. The latter was favored by Richards, even ever the Stones traditionalist, but Jagger was more into the music of the moment, and he insisted on trying to lead the band in those directions. "I think everyone was a bit bored with it, to be honest," Jagger told 60 Minutes later in 1994. It's also hard to ignore a subtext to many of the songs on the Undercover album, some of which are particularly nasty pieces of work, all about sex and violence and disgust. Jagger and Richards were losing patience with each other. The situation veered further off track for the band that same year when Jagger, unbeknownst to his bandmates, secured a solo deal for himself from CBS while the Stones were in negotiations with the label over a new recording contract. For Richards, to whom the Stones are above all else, it was an unforgivable sin. He said, "I don't care who you are, you don't piggyback on a Rolling Stones deal." It was total disregard for the band. Despite their differences, the band came together in 1985 for the funeral of Stewart, the sixth Rolling Stone, who suffered a heart attack at the age of 47. "Stu was a lawn to himself, in his cardigans and his polo shirts," Richards wrote in Life. "When we had expanded into the mega stadiums and satellite television, thousands in the audience, he'd come on stage in his hush puppies with his cup of coffee and his cheese sandwich, which he put on the piano while he played." Jagger refused to tour in support of the band's 1986 album, Dirty Work, choosing instead to promote his own solo work. He even went so far as to play Rolling Stones songs at his concerts. Richards became incensed when he saw Jagger refer to the band in an English tabloid as a millstone around his neck. That was the beginning of what, as Richards calls, World War III. Ever since the Stones' decadent 1972 tour, when the tongue and lips logo emblazoned the side of their private jet, the band had been a must-see concert attraction. But between 1982 and 1989, the Stones did not tour at all. Jagger appeared all by himself at Live Aid in 1985, the same year he released his first solo album entitled She's the Boss. He put out another album, Primitive Cool, 2 years later. Richards followed suit with the album Talk is Cheap, his own solo debut in 1988. As the decade neared its close, the breakup of the Rolling Stones seemed imminent. "I think that one ought to be allowed to have one artistic side apart from just being in the Rolling Stones," Mick Jagger said. "I love the Rolling Stones. I think it's wonderful. I think it's done a lot of wonderful things for music," he said. "But you know, it can't be at my age and after spending all these years the only thing in my life." Jagger's solo career, though, never really got off the ground. The album She's the Boss went platinum in the U.S. after its 1985 release, but the follow-up effort, 1987's Primitive Cool album, barely cracked the top 50. The next year, he called the Stones to a meeting in London's Savoy Hotel and proposed that they go on tour. Richards was reluctant at first, but he agreed to meet Jagger in Barbados to further talk in January 1989, just before the Stones reunited in New York for their induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It was the beginning of the detente of the 80s, Richard said. 2 weeks later, the band was in Montserrat, starting work on a new album. The result of their efforts, the 1989 album Steel Wheels, was released to solid reviews, but the real revelation came from their efforts to support the release. As a touring attraction, the Stones were a huge draw. Beginning in August 1989 and running for 1 year, the Steel Wheels tour grossed $170 million and broke box office records. If friendship and creative stimulation were no longer enough to keep the Rolling Stones motivated, an equally powerful force had entered the mix: money. Ironically, the tour's success was one thing cited by bassist Bill Wyman in January 1993 when he abruptly quit the band. His actual departure came in 1991, but the Stones didn't make the news public about his departure until they found a replacement for Wyman. "I really don't want to do it anymore," Wyman said. "I have many special memories. It's been wonderful," he said. "But I thought the last two tours with them were the best we have ever done, so I was quite happy to stop after that." He went on to say, "When I joined this band, we thought we would last 2 or 3 years, with a bit of luck and come out with a few shillings in our pockets. Now here I am, 30 years later, and I haven't done any of the other important things in my life." Wyman's replacement, touring bassist Daryl Jones, is not actually an official Stone. He's a salaried employee, the same arrangement Ronnie Wood had for many years. Wood said in 2017, "I did my apprenticeship 17 years before I got a raise, before I even thought about money. I was like, do you think I should get a bit more? And the Stones were like, yeah, well, we thought you'd never ask. Those who don't ask don't want me." Officially, there were only 4 Rolling Stones by the end of the third decade. The band was getting smaller, but they represented to rock and roll. What they represented to rock and roll was only getting bigger. So the 10 best songs from 1983 to 1989, as chosen by the site You Discover Music, include number 1, Undercover of the Night, number 2, Mixed Emotions, number 3, She Was Hot, number 4, Harlem Shuffle, number 5, Almost Hear You Sigh, number 6, One Hit to the Body, number 7, Winning Ugly, number 8, Rockin' a Hard Place, number 9, Too Much Blood, and number 10, Sleep Tonight. 4 decades in, the Rolling Stones were a touring force, with more live shows than ever, churning out hard-driving rock and refusing to be seen as a nostalgia act. The Rolling Stones started calling themselves the world's greatest rock band in the late 1960s, and after the record-breaking tour that supported the 1989 Steel Wheels album, it was hard to argue that it wasn't true. As the tour proved, night after night, the Stones still had it, and the fact that they did, despite 7 years off the road and a decade in the wilderness, was even more impressive. The traveling show was the longest in their history, running for 12 months, with 60 performances in the U.S., followed by 10 in Tokyo, and then 45 in Europe, more dates than even the band's biggest caravans of the 1960s and 70s. By the time it ended with a blowout at London's Wembley Stadium on August 25, 1990, the show closer that night was "I Can't Get No Satisfaction." The Stones had returned to the top of the rock and roll heap. It was a remarkable bit of magic, with the band churning out riffy, hard-driving rock and refusing to become a nostalgia act. But when the Stones left the stage at Wembley, everyone was well into the middle age. Bill Wyman was 53, Charlie Watts was 49, Mick Jagger was 47, Keith Richards 46, and Ronnie Wood was 43. They were the world's greatest rock band, but not quite a band of immortals, and the Stones needed a break. And that's exactly what they did. The middle-aged bluesmen went their separate ways for a few years. Wyman quit the band and concentrated on his pub named Sticky Fingers, which was shuttered in 2021 due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Jagger, Richards, and Wood all put out solo albums with modest success. Watts formed a jazz quintet and released a pair of albums that paid tribute to Charlie Parker. Besides a live record in 1991, comprising music from the Steel Wheels tour, the world heard nothing from the Rolling Stones for 5 years. But unlike prior prolonged breaks, this time the Stones had no intention of going away. "It's kind of like an adventure, the Stones," said Richards in 1993. "You can't give up now. Once you're in, you take it to the end. If you get off the bus now, you'd spend the rest of your time wondering where the end of the line was. We're the only ones here, so in a way there's a duty to see how far you can take it. I think there's a possibility of another gold period in the Stones somewhere." 5 years between albums was, up to that point, an eternity in the life of the Rolling Stones. Even the dark days of the 1980s, the most time that had passed between the band's studio releases was only 3 years. When Voodoo Lounge hit stores in 1994, the demand was intense. It debuted at number one in the UK and number two in the US, and it eventually went platinum. On March 1, 1995, Voodoo Lounge won the Grammy for Best Rock Album. Incredibly, it was the Stones' first Grammy Award for their music. They won the Lifetime Achievement Award first back in 1987. Voodoo Lounge was met with generally positive reviews from critics, and while it didn't produce any significant songs on the charts, it did sound very much like the Stones. A big reason for that was because the band was working with producer Don Was, who made a priority to protect the Stones' legacy. He didn't want to do anything that was below the standard of that stuff from the late 60s and early 70s, said Keith Richards. Despite the now ever-present tension between the two leaders, the band hit the road in support of Voodoo in August of 94 and didn't stop performing for 13 months. The Stones played more shows in more countries for more people than ever before. By the time it was over, they had also earned more money, grossing a record $320 million. And the show they put on was undeniably great. "There were lots of hacks out there who said we couldn't do it anymore," said the 51-year-old Jagger at the time. "But maybe what they meant was they couldn't do it anymore. Anyway, once we started playing, all that died down. You can talk about it and talk about it, but once we're on stage, the question is answered." The Stones, as was their habit, followed up the album and tour with a live set. But unlike the hiatus between Steel Wheels and Voodoo Lounge, they then got right back to work. Bridges to Babylon came out in 1997, and while it wasn't as consistent a piece of art as Voodoo, Jagger, who rarely appeared in the studio with Richards, had brought in several other producers to work under Was to modernize the band's sound. It was extremely popular. Babylon sold over 1 million copies in the U.S., where it rose to number three, and produced a worldwide top 40 hit, "Anybody See My Baby?" More importantly, it led to another lucrative traveling tour. This time around, the Stones grossed $274 million, making the Bridge to Babylon tour the band's second most successful of all time, behind only their previous tour. "Every time you go out, I suppose it's like testing yourself again," Jagger said. "But I just find it enjoyable and challenging, and you know, it's not going to go on forever, is it?" Well, it seemed like it might. By the end of their fourth decade, the Stones had morphed into such a touring force that it was easy to forget that music was still at the heart of everything they did. To remind their fans of that, the band launched another tour in 1999 that saw them play fewer dates at smaller venues around the world. The band still rocked harder than acts half their age. The Rolling Stones were now officially a quartet, four men all nearly 60, and they were winning. "Age doesn't really matter to me," Richard said. "Just point me in the right direction. As long as the stage is there, it's cool." The top 10 all-live performances by the Stones, as ranked by the site You Discover Music, included Copacabana Beach in Rio de Janeiro in 2006, Ford Field in Detroit in 2006 at Super Bowl 40, Hyde Park, London in 1969, Hyde Park, London in 2013, Checkerboard Lounge in Chicago in 1981, the Marquee Club in London in 1971, London in 1968, Tarrant County Convention Center in Fort Worth, Texas in 1972, The Ed Sullivan Show in 1968, and London Stadium in 2018. In the early 2000s, the Stones survived cancer and catastrophe and seemed to be unstoppable. Their primary focus during this time, secure the band's legacy. In June 2002, Mick Jagger received word that he'd been named to Queen Elizabeth II's Jubilee Birthday Honors list. This meant he was due to be knighted and would soon become Sir Mick. Keith Richards was apoplectic. His objections were many, but chief among them was the fact that he didn't feel that Jagger should be accepting an honor from an establishment that had, back in 1967, convicted him and Richards on drug charges. The Stones were all about rebellion. Knighthood literally represented bowing to the system. Says Richards, "What did I feel when I heard? Cold, cold rage at Jagger's blind stupidity. It was enraging, but quite simply, Mick's fucked up so many times, what's another fuck up?" In an act of pure rebellion against Richards, Mick Jagger followed through on his knighthood and set the tone for the Stones' fifth decade as a band. From here on out, the albums and tours were about shoring up a legacy. The first milestone was the celebration of the band's 40th anniversary, marked by the release of 40 Licks, a compilation of the Rolling Stones' greatest hits from the 1960s through the 1990s. Made up of impeccable music, the album was a massive hit, reaching number two in both the US and in the UK, and sending the band out on a 14-month tour. Like seemingly every Stones caravan, it was another record breaker. The 40 Licks tour grossed more than $300 million, making it the second most lucrative tour in history behind the Stones' own Voodoo Lounge tour nearly a decade before. From right out of the gate, from those first gigs onwards, there was an amazing feeling on the tour, said Richards in 03. Charlie Watts and bassist Daryl Jones were on their third tour together and had forged this immense rhythm section, and the band as a whole was continuing to evolve, to find itself, he said. I think the Stones are still looking for the ultimate Stones. It's like the Holy Grail. He went on to say, whether we ever find it or not is immaterial. It's the quest that's important. For the years, the Stones had, to a certain extent, kept aging at bay. Jagger especially was in a remarkable shape, sprinting around the touring stage like a man half his age, which at the end of the Licks tour was 60. But when Charlie Watts was diagnosed with throat cancer in June 2004, things ground to a halt. Jagger and Richards had been working on new material at Jagger's home in France when they got the news. The plan had been to release an album, the first in 8 years, and then to hit the road. We had okayed the tour, said Jagger in 05. Charlie was straight up about it. The doctor says I have a 90% chance of being completely cured. If Charlie had said, I can't do this tour, I face mortality, Jagger said, we would have had to change our minds. No one pressured him, but the treatments couldn't have been easy. Watts returned after 6 weeks of chemotherapy to help Jagger and Richards finish the album entitled A Bigger Bang. The band's 24th album of original material, Bang, was lean and confident. It didn't include any new classics, but it did showcase the Stones at their bluey's, funky, sleazy best, and true to form, they promptly hit the road in support of it. The Stones spent 2 years on a tour that, by the time it was over, had grossed almost $560 million, making it the most lucrative tour of all time. It was not without incident, however. While vacationing on a private island in Fiji during a break in April 06, Richards slipped while jumping off a branch and slammed his head on a tree trunk. He suffered seizures 2 days later and was flown to Auckland, New Zealand, with a blood clot in his brain. After surgeons removed the clot, he was told he should take the next 6 months off. Richards was back on tour in 6 weeks. Through cancer and catastrophe, the Stones appeared to be unstoppable, but quietly they were slowing down. A live album followed the Bang tour, but it was not like any live set the Stones had ever released. The band opted for a live prestige project, a concert film called Shine a Light, directed by Martin Scorsese. Footage was filmed over 2 nights at New York's Beacon Theater in 2006, with proceeds benefiting the Clinton Foundation. Joining the Stones on stage were Jack White, Buddy Guy, and Christina Aguilera. Mick was on fire, Watts said. You can tell in the third song when Lisa Fisher, the singer, does a shimmy with him and you see the look on her face. He dances like Fred Astaire going backwards. The band went into a hibernation of sorts after that, with the focus on legacy becoming more intense. In 2010, Richards wrote his autobiography, Life, which won a New York Times bestseller award and a 2011 Norman Mailer Prize. In it, Richards wrote critically and at times lovingly of Jagger, calling him unbearable. He was a bit peeved about this and that, Richards said, but Mick and I are still great friends and still want to work together. Can you imagine if everybody agreed nothing would happen, there would be no blues? By the beginning of their 50th year together, the Rolling Stones were as recognizable and more financially successful than they had been at their artistic peak back in the 60s and 70s. By the start of their 50th year together, the Rolling Stones had achieved something remarkable in rock and pop culture. Simply put, they were as well known as they'd ever been before, and they were also more financially successful than at any time in their history, even more when they were at their artistic peak in the late 60s and early 70s. In 1975, a then 32-year-old Jagger famously told People magazine, "I'd rather be dead than sing Satisfaction when I'm 45 years old." Many took Jagger to mean that he didn't want to become an aging rocker, but what he really meant was he didn't want to keep going just for the sake of nostalgia. The 21st century version of the Rolling Stones were much more than an oldies act. They were still relevant. The Stones had outlasted their contemporaries in the British invasion by more than 40 years, and they still mattered. Keep on rolling, indeed. Between 1988 and 2011, the Stones earned more than $2 billion in gross revenues. This included money earned from not only their epic road shows, but also sponsorship deals such as with Anheuser-Busch and E-Trade. The band licensed songs to Microsoft and Apple and lent its music and its name to around 50 products, everything from underwear to Volkswagen. In 2010, the New Yorker's David Remnick wrote, "The Stones logo is as recognizable on the corporate landscape as the Golden Arches." The Stones had evolved into more than just a band. They represented a multitude of businesses, including offshoots in touring, recording, publishing, and sponsorship. For tax reasons, the four members of the group created four separate companies to handle the different aspects of their enterprises. The band also employed a small army of accountants, immigration lawyers, and security professionals. Jagger's personal fortune was an estimated $310 million in 2010, a testament to the Stones' shrewd business acumen. You can delegate things to other people, and you have to a certain extent, Jagger told the New York Times Magazine in 2010, going on to say, but if you're not behind it and getting your knowledge and input into it, it's not going to turn out as interestingly, and probably it won't be what you would like. It'd still be disappointing. In 2012, the group directed all those resources towards marking the band's 50th anniversary. There is a 5.5-pound coffee table book, a documentary entitled Crossfire Hurricane that covered the Stones' beginnings through 1981, and a 3-disc compilation of their biggest songs entitled GRRR. The band also, of course, went out on the road. In early July, almost 50 years to the day since their first live performance, the Stones returned to pose for photos in front of London's Marquee Club, the site of their debut, still in Soho, but at a different address. 3 months later, they kicked off the 50 and Counting tour in London. The shows included guests such as Mary J. Blige, Taylor Swift, and Bruce Springsteen, but there were also appearances by former Stones Bill Wyman and Mick Taylor as well. From day one of the rehearsals, it sounded so fresh, Keith Richards said. You could tell that everybody was dying to get their teeth into it. It was like, open the gates, let us out, because man, it is the life and blood of us to play in front of people. At 50 and counting, ended in July 2013, the Stones never really stopped playing in front of people. From February 2014 to March of 2016, they struck out on three different small tours. They then released their first studio album in 11 years. Blue and Lonesome is, as of 2022, the band's last studio effort and a fitting coda to 1964's The Rolling Stones, England's newest hitmakers, their first release. Besides Jagger Richards' penned Tell Me, Hitmakers was a collection of blue and rock covers. It was quite fun, Richards said of making Blue and Lonesome. We did a whole week in a little room, slowly putting a new album together. Since her first comeback tour in 1989, every Stones show had been accompanied by the speculation that this might be their last chance to see them perform. By 2019, the band was still proving its doubters wrong. Jagger had been running sprints across gargantuan stage sets for 30 years. Richards, who had survived his addiction to heroin, cocaine, mescaline, LSD, and other drugs, had cheated death for so long that it seemed indescribable. When the Stones launched their No Filter tour in September 2017, there seemed little reason to think that it wouldn't play out much like their other road shows from years past, selling out stadiums and breaking box office records. But in March 2019, No Filter paused abruptly for 3 months. Jagger, 75, needed emergency surgery to replace a valve in his heart. After 3 decades of defying Father Time, age was catching up to the Stones, though Jagger's phenomenal fitness level seemed to work in his favor. By June, the band was back on the road. Mick went through it very easily, Richard said. He's in great shape, rocking. As I say, it seemed to be no problem at all, really. The problems, though, were just beginning. On August 5th, 2021, while preparing to play a leg of the tour that had already been delayed by COVID-19, the Stones announced that Charlie Watts would not be accompanying the band on a swing through North America while he recovered from an unspecified medical procedure. 19 days later, the Stones' laconic, stone-faced drummer, who had beaten throat cancer in 2004, died in a London hospital with his family by his side. The thing about Charlie was that he was always there, always played beautifully, and was always willing to discuss what to do about it, how he could make it better, Jagger said. He held the band together for so long musically because he was the rock the rest of it was built around. In St. Louis on September 26, 2021, a month and 2 days after Watts' death, the band started the No Filter tour with drummer Steve Jordan taking its place. It's a very surreal feeling, Ronnie Wood, of playing without Watts, said. It's like I've done this before, but there's a strange thing. I've never done this before in the air as well. The Stones had begun as a six-man band in 1962. They were down to just 3 official members now. The only original members left were Jagger and Richards. When the No Filter tour finally came to an end in November 2021, the band's future was, for the first time in a long time, uncertain. And we wrap up this feature article on Mick and Jagger and 60 years together by listing the Stones' top 10 albums as ranked by Far Out magazine. Number 1, Exile on Main Street. Number 2, Sticky Fingers. Number 3, Beggar's Banquet. Number 4, Let It Bleed. Number 5, Some Girls. Number 6, Tattoo You. Number 7, Goat's Head Soup. Number 8, Emotional Rescue. Number 9, Her Satanic Majesty's Request. And number 10, Steel Wheels. And this wraps up another edition of Rolling Stone. Thank you for listening. This has been Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.